Hi, this is Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault. This week, we hear the gravelly voice of the indelible playwright and left-wing activist Lillian Hellman, whose life was as dramatic as the plays she penned. In this program, we will examine her life growing up both in New York City and in New Orleans, and her chance meeting with mystery writer Dashiell Hammett, who helped inspire her to write. Her illustrious career includes the American classic plays The Children's Hour, The Little Foxes, Toys in the Attic, and Pentimento, which she had just completed at the time of the original broadcast of today's program back in 1975. We begin with a conversation between Pacifica producer Jan Albert and Lillian Hellman from the Pacifica Radio Archives recording entitled The Sweetest Smelling Baby in New Orleans.
Almost your whole body of work until An Unfinished Woman in Pentimento were your plays and your screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's one thing that sets you immediately aside from most other people who have spent years participating in the theater, doing designing or scenery or writing or acting, and that's that you haven't been too comfortable in it. There's a whole side of you that didn't like the whole scene, and you write continually again and again about your conflict about the theater, your many years in the theater. I wondered if you could explain a little bit about this conflict.
As I said in the book, it's too difficult. I almost couldn't write about it, so it's very hard to talk about it. How does one know what makes a conflict? You know, a thousand things make a conflict. Sure. I obviously wanted to write for the theater, and I obviously had some gifts for writing in the theater, but there were conflicts about my opinions about the theater and my nature in the theater. It's very hard to pinpoint conflicts, and I'm never sure I believe people when they do.
Hammett, I guess he said it really well when he said the only time you liked the theater was when you were alone in the room.
Yes.
Putting it down on paper.
Yes, I think that's true. I'm not a collaborator by nature.
But
just on my own, I think.
Did you go to the theater a lot before you wrote your first play?
I went to the theater a lot as a much younger girl than that, yes. I went to the theater a great deal from the time I was about 12 till I was about 18 and 19.
Did the whole scene interest you as an outsider? I mean, did the glamour appeal to you then?
Well, as an outsider, you don't see much glamour, and I certainly was an outsider. No, I just went because I had a nice time. I enjoyed it.
It interests me that you talk about an instinct for theater writing. I mean, why theater then? You didn't know, of course, at the time when you started writing plays that you'd have this whole problem with collaboration and such, I guess.
Nor did I know I had the instinct. I don't know. I suppose you can go in a circle. I probably wouldn't have started unless I'd had some instinct. But I don't remember any knowledge that I had any instinct.
Here is Jan Albert reading from Lillian Hellman's 1969 autobiography, An Unfinished Woman.
You are good in boats not alone from knowledge, but because water is a part of you. You're easy on it, fear it and like it in such equal parts that you work well in a boat without thinking about it, and may even be safer because you don't need to think too much. That is what we mean by instinct. And there's no way to explain an instinct for the theater, although those who have it recognize each other and a bond is formed between them. The need of a theater instinct may be why so many good writers have been such inferior playwrights. The light that a natural dramatist can see on a dark road is simply not there.
I went through the last couple of plays thinking, this isn't a world for me, and I always knew it wasn't when I was very young and started to write for the theater. But in those days, I suppose I didn't care. And the Depression came along, and I needed a job, and started reading plays for a living. And I think it was the reading of plays that made me sort of wanted to write a play, because I had certainly never thought of it before that. And it probably was just about that I'd read so many bad plays that I thought, well, maybe I can write a play. What other motivation there was, I don't know. I had written short stories, and they hadn't been very good. They hadn't been bad, but they hadn't been very good either. And I at least had sense enough to know that. And I suppose I was looking for a form in which I was at home, and indeed I found the form in which I was at home. No matter what I say about the theater or think about it, I'm at home in it. By nature, I'm at home in it. As I'm at home at this minute facing you, because it is a theater. And I don't know how to explain that. Nor do I explain, can I explain the fact that that one doesn't like what one's at home with.
Alexandra!
Hello, Mama.
What's this racket going on out here?
Oh, Mama, I didn't think you'd mind.
You may remember we're having company for supper tonight. You'd better come up and start your hair.
And that was the voice of Tallulah Bankhead, who originated the role of the avaricious Regina Giddens in the first Broadway production of The Little Foxes.
You grew up half in New Orleans, half in New York, and it must have caused a lot of strange influences, different influences from both sides. I wonder if we could start by your telling me a little bit about that and about the people you were surrounded with as a kid.
Well, it's always hard in a few sentences to sum up one's childhood. New Orleans and New York were, of course, very different. New Orleans, particularly when I grew up, because it was a rather poor city. It's now a boom city, of course, and a quite rich city. When I grew up, it was not a rich, in general, a rich city. The school systems were quite different. I think New Orleans systems in those days were way behind New York systems. This naturally made a little girl uncomfortable, going from one kind of school system into another kind of school system. I was always just, I rode ahead of my class in New Orleans and way behind it in New York. And I was moved from one school to many other schools, in a single place like New York. As far as the children went, I don't know that one as a child makes much difference. I think I liked my friends here better because, of course, in the end, we came to live here. But I was at least 15, 16 years old before we stopped this commuting that we
What
that we
caused
did.
The commuting back and forth?
Well, my father took long business trips of 4 and 5 months a year, and then they thought it best to go back to New Orleans for that time. My mother did. Well, I guess he did, too. And we'd stay with my aunts. As I've written, my aunt has a very pleasant boarding house, and I guess my mother liked it there. Probably was lonely in New York without him. I suppose that was the reason. I never asked, of course.
It must have been quite incredible living in a boarding house, sort of like a child's fantasy, imagining all the lives of the different boarders.
Yes, it was. It was fun, now that I look back on it. I was so interested in everybody, of course. It wasn't always fun. You didn't have very much privacy, of course. Boarding houses in New Orleans, in much of the South, were not boarding houses as one possibly knows them now, but more like French pensions. You took 2 meals a day and sometimes 3 meals a day. People weren't just in rooms. You ate with them most of the time. Sometimes we ate privately, all family. But my one aunt, she did a great deal of the cooking. My other aunt worked an outside job.
Here's Jan Albert reading from Lillian Hellman's 1969 autobiography, An Unfinished Woman.
I liked my time in New Orleans much better than I liked our 6 months apartment life in New York. The life in my aunt's boarding house seemed remarkably rich. I think I learned to laugh in that house and to knit and embroider and sew a straight seam and to cook. Every Sunday it was my job to clean the crawfish for the wonderful bisque. And it was Jenny and Carrie, the cook, who taught me to make turtle soup, and how to kill a chicken without ladylike complaints about the horror of dealing death, and how to pluck and cook the wild ducks that were hawked on our street every Sunday morning. I was taught also that if you gave, you did it without piety, and you didn't boast about it. It had been one of my grandfather's laws, in the days when my father and aunts were children, that no poor person who asked for anything was ever to be refused, and his children fulfilled the injunction. New Orleans was a city of many poor people, particularly black people, and the boarding house kitchen after the house dinner was, on most nights, a mighty pleasant place. There would often be as many as 8 or 10 people, black and white, almost always very old or very young, who sat at the table on the kitchen porch while Carrie ordered the kitchen maids and me to bring the steaming platters and coffee pots. My aunts Jenny and Hannah were both tall, large women, funny and generous, who, coming from a German-cultivated genteel tradition, had found that they had to earn a living, and they earned it without complaint, although Jenny the prettier and more complex had frequent outbursts of interesting temper. It was strange, I thought then, that my mother, who so often irritated me, was treated by my aunts as if she was a precious Chinese clay piece from a world they didn't know. And in a sense, that was true. Her family was rich. She was small, delicately made, and charming. She was a sturdy, brave woman, really, but it took years to teach me that. I think both Hannah and Jenny were virgins, but if they were, there were no signs of spinsterhood. They were nice about married people, they were generous to children, and sex was something to have fun about. Jenny had been the consultant to many neighborhood young ladies before their marriage night, or the night of their first lover. One of these girls, a rich ninny, Jenny found irritating and unpleasant. When I was 16, I came across the two of them in earnest conference on the lawn, and later Jenny told me that the girl had come to consult her about how to avoid pregnancy. "What did you tell her?" "I told her to have a glass of ice water right before the sacred act, and 3 sips during it." When we had finished laughing, I said, "But she's going to get pregnant. He's marrying her for her money. He'll leave her when he gets it. This way, at least, maybe she'll have a few babies for herself." And 4 years later, when I wrote my aunts that I was going to be married, I had back a telegram. "Forget about the glass of ice water. Times have changed."
It had been my plan to be a writer, as well as my plan to be an architect. I soon realized I would never be an architect. But I had written all my life till I was about 22, 23, and then I decided I wasn't any good. So I stopped. I didn't think I was any good, so I stopped writing and never really resumed it until after I met Hammett, Dashiell Hammett.
I'm just going to take care of my wife's money, so I'll have something in my old age.
You said you retired in New York, but I noticed you took that Tin Man case.
Oh, that Tin Man was a few. They're still talking about it.
Again, that's what
for the news, Nick? Dig us up another Tin Man, will you, Nick?
Oh, that was a great case, Nick.
You'd take a case like that, wouldn't you, Nick?
No, I only took that to please my wife. She wanted some excitement.
Well, I guess she had it.
Oh, it was wonderful. 2 men tried to kill him, but he's not going to take any more cases. You can print that.
That's my darling.
An excerpt from Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man, starring William Powell and Myrna Loy. Again, Jan Albert, reading from Lillian Hellman's 1969 autobiography, An Unfinished Woman.
For years, we made jokes about the day I would write about him. In the early years, I would say, "Tell me more about the girl in San Francisco, the silly one who lived across the hall in Pine Street." And he would laugh and say, "She lived across the hall in Pine Street and was silly. Tell more than that. How much did you like her, and how..." He would yawn. "Finish your drink and go to sleep." But days later, maybe even that night, if I was on a find-out kick, and I was most of the years, I would say, "Okay, be stubborn about the girls. So tell me about your grandmother and what you look like as a baby." "I was a very fat baby. My grandmother went to the movies every day. She was very fond of a movie star called Wallace Reed, and I've told you all this before." I would say I wanted to get everything straight for the days after his death when I would write his biography, and he would say I was not to bother writing his biography because it would turn out to be the history of Lillian Hellman with an occasional reference to a friend called Hammett. The day of his death came on January 10, 1961. I'm never going to write that biography because I cannot write about my closest, my most beloved friend. We met when I was 24 years old and he was 36 in a restaurant in Hollywood. The 5-day drunk had left the wonderful face looking rumpled, and the very tall, thin figure was tired and sagged. We talked of T.S. Eliot, although I no longer remember what we said, and then went and sat in his car and talked at each other and over each other until it was daylight. We were to meet again a few weeks later, and after that, on and sometimes off again, for the rest of his life and 30 years of mine.
You got back to writing after you met Hammett, right?
Yes.
You represent him as being the person who started you writing again. I mean, how did that come about?
I don't think there was any plan or plot to it. I think he just encouraged me to. I don't remember any day or any hour or minute. I think it was just an encouragement to start again.
Your first play, The Children's Hour, was a huge success. And I wondered how you came to write it, how you came up with the topic of the play, the subject of the play. It's such a powerful subject, and it would be even if the implied lesbianism wasn't there, because of the evil children spreading stories and ruining adults' lives, the sort of bad seed concept.
The Children's Hour was actually based on a real case written by, it happened in Scotland in the 19th century, and written by a man called William Rufford, who was a lawyer and who wrote a number of quite good books about Scotch law cases. And the actual case was two middle-aged ladies who ran a boarding school in Scotland and who took into the school an Indian girl, an Indian girl, half Indian, half Scotch. And she seems to have made accusations about them. They brought suit and sued to the end of their lives, evidently broke themselves and died, I think, without ever winning. I don't remember really what they won or lost. And I obviously did a great deal of changing there, but certainly that was the basic idea.
I was looking back through articles about your plays, and I found one that spoke of a woman having great difficulty in dealing with the changing sexual mores of the time. And I wondered, did the subject hit? What was the reaction to the subject of lesbianism? Was it as hard as it is to the night porter is to a lot of us now? Was it that strong, or was it very an accepted topic?
No, I don't think it was an accepted topic. We were all... Well, the play has nothing to do with lesbianism, of course. It's just one of the side issues.
Right.
It's just the charge of the girl, that's all.
Right.
But Mr. Shumlin, the producer, was very worried. Everybody was very worried because a play called The Captive, a French play, had played in New York a few years before and been closed up by the police department. So we took every precaution. The children, the so-called children, were all over 18 years old in the play.
Oh, yeah.
And we observed every possible fire law, which no theater does. People smoke backstage. We were very, very careful to be... It was banned in many cities. It was banned in Boston for many years. It was banned in Chicago for many years. Here we had no trouble at all. Because I really don't think people who saw it ever thought of it as a lesbian play. But it was banned in many places. We finally won both the Chicago and Boston suits, but... after many, many years. Yes, it was a forbidden topic.
Did you really have a pain?
I fainted, didn't I?
I wish I could faint sometimes.
What were you two doing?
We heard Miss Dobie and Miss Mortar having an awful fight.
A fight?
Rosalie dropped the book and there we were.
And a lot of crawling and crying. You both did too, I bet. What were they fighting about?
Miss Dobie wants Mortar to go to England. And Mortar got sore at that. And she said she knew why Miss Dobie wanted to get rid of her.
Oh.
What's the matter?
Nothing. She got her arm caught in the door and Miss Dobie was closing it.
Oh, something's always happening to you.
Well, I'm going to start moving my things before Miss Wright comes up.
Ah, go on.
Well, Dr. Carden and Miss Wright are going to get married.
Oh, everybody knows that, stupid.
But everybody doesn't know that Miss Dobie doesn't want them to get married. How do you like that?
Why doesn't she?
Dee, 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 dee.
Why doesn't she?
Because she is in love with Dr. Carden, too. That's why.
Go on.
And Mortar said she knew it all along. And then she said an awful lot of funny things about them. And all about one night late, when Dr. Carden was up in Miss Dobie's room. What does she mean, I wonder? It's a shame we have to move. I've got to go in with Helen, and she blows her nose all night. Lois told me.
You better start moving.
I'm not going. I'm going home.
What?
I'm going home.
Why, you can't do that.
Can I? You just watch and see.
And your grandmother will send you right back.
What are you going to tell her?
Oh, I'll think of something. I can always do it better on the spur of the moment.
Grandma, I'm scared. They've got something against me, and they punished me for everything. Today, they even said I couldn't go to the boat races.
Oh, but it wasn't that, Grandma. It's things, other things, funny things.
Oh, what nonsense are you talking?
They've got secrets, Grandma, funny secrets. All about Miss Dobie and Dr. Carden, and Mrs. Mortar told Miss Dobie that she knew what was going on.
What?
That she knew what was going on, and she had always known about what was going on.
Well, stop using that silly phrase,
but
Mary.
But that's what she kept using, Grandma. And Miss Dobie said she'd have to get out of the house. That's why we had to move our rooms, I bet, because they're frightened we'll hear things, too.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about, but I don't think I like it. If anything puzzled you, you should have gone to Miss Wright or Miss Dobie.
But they would have punished me more and more and more. I guess they knew about how I couldn't help hearing about that awful night that...
What awful night?
Well, Dr. Carden was in Miss Dobie's room late and other times when things happened, too. But I can't say them out loud, Grandma. I've got to whisper.
Nonsense. Why must you whisper?
Because I got to. Because it's bad. Well, it was late at night and Miss Dobie's room was right next to ours. And...
Mary! Do you know what you're saying? Are you telling me the truth?
Honest, honest.
Mrs. Munn, please. This is Mrs. Tilford. Miriam, this is Amelia Tilford. I have something to tell you. Something very shocking, I'm afraid. It's about the school, about Mary and Evelyn.
That was actress Benita Granville from the 1936 MGM film adaptation of The Children's Hour, retitled These Three. Granville was nominated for a Best Supporting Actress Academy Award for her performance.
The Children's Hour, which was my first play, was backed by the Schuberts. And I so little knew it because Mr. Shumlin produced it. I didn't pay any attention to the fact that we were rehearsing in a Schubert theater. And I was quite young. I was 26, I guess. Which doesn't explain why I had a habit of putting my feet up on the seat in front of me. But I did have a habit of sitting that way all day. And suddenly a little man came down an aisle one day and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Take your feet off that seat." And I turned around in absolute shock that anybody would speak to me this way. And I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "Just take your feet off the seat of my theater. Just take your..." And I strode to the stage and said to Herman Shumlin, who was the producer-director, "Somebody has come down the aisle and told me to take my feet off the seat." And Mr. Shumlin said, "Mr. Schubert, get out of here. This is the author. Get out of here." And Mr. Schubert left. And then I said, "What right beyond owning the theater did he have?" And Mr. Shumlin said, "Well, I must tell you, he put up the money for the play." Which I had never known before, and I never saw Mr. Schubert except the opening night of The Little Fox of the same play, which was a miserable, turned out to be a great opening night, but was a kind of mess, because the Schuberts had decided that we weren't worth very much. We were put in the Maxine Elliott Theater on 39th Street, shortly to be demolished. And they hadn't... in the balcony, downstairs got proper programs. Upstairs, where I sat to look at the play, they handed out a program I still have called Sunset Grove, which was the play that had opened and closed about 8 days before, and people were just going around handing these.
I've always told myself that I was so drunk on the opening night of the children's hour, because I'd begun to drink two nights before. I had gone to have dinner with my mother and father, who had not read the play. They'd not seen the rehearsals and had asked no questions, but obviously had talked to each other when they were alone. Both of them were proud of me, but in my family you just didn't show such things, and both of them, I think, were frightened for me in a world they didn't know. In any case, my mother, who frequently made sentences that had nothing to do with what went before, said, in space, "Well, all I know is that you were considered the sweetest-smelling baby in New Orleans." She had, through my life, told me this several times before, describing how two strange ladies had paused in front of our house to stare at me in the baby carriage, and then to lean down and sniff me. One of them had said, "That's the sweetest-smelling baby in town." The other had said, "In all New Orleans." And when my mother told our neighbor about her pleasure in this exchange, the neighbor had said, "Of course it was true. Famously true. I always smelled fresh as a flower." I didn't know that my mother had never until that night told my father. Or if she had, he was less nervous than he was two nights before the opening. Now when she repeated it, he said, "Who was the sweetest-smelling baby in New Orleans?" "Lillian," said my mother. "Lillian?" "Lillian," said my father. "I was the sweetest-smelling baby in New Orleans, and you got that information from my mother and sisters and have stolen it." "Stolen it," said my shocked mother. "I never stole anything in my life, and you know it. Lillian was the sweetest-smelling baby in New Orleans, and I can prove it." "It's disgraceful," said my father, "what you're doing. You've taken what people said about me, always said about me, and given it to your own child." "Your child, too," said my mother. "That's no reason for lying and stealing," said my father. "I must ask you now to take it back, and not to repeat it again." My mother was a gentlewoman and would do almost anything to avoid a fight, but now she was aroused as I had never before seen her. "I will take nothing back. You're depriving your own child of her rightful honor, and I think it disgraceful." My father rose from the table. "I will telephone Jenny and prove it to you," he said. He was giving the phone operator the number of his sister's house in New Orleans when my mother yelled, "Jenny and Hannah will say anything you tell them to. I won't have it. Lillian was the sweetest-smelling baby in New Orleans, and that's that." She began to cry. I said, "I think maybe you're both crazy." I went to the sideboard and poured myself a large straight whiskey. My father, holding the phone, said to me, "Sweet-smelling, are you? You've been drinking too much for years." "Don't pay him any mind, baby," said my mother. "Any man who would deny his own child." I left before my father spoke to his sisters, and only found out months later that although my mother and father came to the opening night together, and both of them kissed me, they didn't speak to each other for several days. On the afternoon of the opening night of the children's hour, I drowned the hangover with brandy. I think I saw the play from the back of the theater, holding to the rail, but I'm not sure. I do remember the final curtain and an audience yelling, "Author! Author!" It was not all modesty that kept me from the curtain call. I couldn't have made it backstage without falling. I wish I had understood and been happy in all the excited noise that comes only when the author is unknown and will never come again in quite so generous a fashion.
You are listening to The Sweetest Smelling Baby in New Orleans, The Life and Times of Lillian Hellman on From the Vault.